established a careful budget and made regular monthly payments to repay our debts. In 1961, Dad went on a health food binge, stocking the shelves and refrigerator with an array of foods that Bruce and I loathed, including oriental herbs, tofu, and beef tongue. Convinced that beef tongue provided more nutrients and proteins than any other form of meat, he forced us to eat the foul substance in a variety of forms, including tongue sandwiches with mayonnaise on the bread and a tongue stew, both of which made me gag worse than green clam guts. I hated any form of tongue, especially the texture of the meat, which had sickening little bumps on it. Our father also began consuming large quantities of vitamin pills, particularly vitamin C, and loaded up on brewer's yeast, which he sprinkled on many of the meals we ate. The latter had a rather strong flavor, but I got used to it and even grew to favor it. Dad said it gave us more energy. He extolled the virtues of honey as a natural source of energy, and kept several varieties of it in the kitchen. Bruce and I protested, to no avail, having to drink a nasty mixture of vinegar and honey, which Dad served to us at breakfast. Every once in a while, Bruce or I didn't heed one of the oft-repeated rules of our father's house, and crumbs got into one of the honey jars. "Who got crumbs in the honey?" Dad would shout at the top of his lungs. "Uh-oh," the guilty party would think. The standard punishment for crumbs in the honey was a long lecture and yet another demonstration of the proper method. "Do it like this," Dad would say in an irritated tone, dipping a clean butter knife in the jar. Withdrawing the knife, he then spun it slowly, using the motion to keep a gob of honey from dripping. He held the honey over a piece of whole wheat toast and let the golden syrup drip down. "See? The blade never touches the toast. Now you can dip the knife back in and keep the honey clean." "Okay, Dad," Bruce or I would say, and we would promise to do it right the next time. Anyway, our intentions were good. Before each lecture, he would utter the familiar words, "I want your undivided attention." He was always repeating himself, which explains in part why Bruce and I frequently tuned him out. We knew it was risky to do so, but we just couldn't stand listening to him anymore. He saw too many details, expected perfection from us. Like many characters in his stories, he was hyper-aware. Our every action was viewed through a high-powered microscope. His attention to detail came from a perceived need to run our household with military precision, so that all would be orderly around him. An enforced environment that allowed him the serenity to create. My parents thrived in San Francisco. Immersing themselves in the culture of one of the world's great regions, they were putting down roots. Mom even crocheted a large San Francisco map rug, with marks showing the location of our house, the San Francisco Examiner, and the White House department store. In our backyard, her roses were blooming, and Mom regularly placed vases of cut flowers on our dining room table. Above all else in his life, my father was consumed with research for his big novel, set in the desert. In this effort, he would eventually read more than 200 books. He studied Oriental and Arabic languages and literature so extensively that he could think and write in those languages. He discovered the Japanese haiku and tonka poetry forms, and was fascinated by their pristine simplicity and beauty. They had a strange and alien power, he thought, in which they captured the essence of all life. Dad sold 6 science fiction short stories in the 3-year period of 1960 to 1962. The Priests of Psi, Fantastic, February 1960, Egg and Ashes, If, November 1960, AWF Unlimited, Galaxy, June 1961, Mating Call, Galaxy, October 1961, Try to Remember, Amazing, October 1961, and Mindfield, Amazing, March 1962. His writing income during that period averaged only a few $100 annually. Still, he remained in contact with the science fiction community, attending local science fiction conventions and other functions. He met science fiction writer Frederick Pohl at a party at Paul Anderson's house. Science fiction writers Reginald Bretner and Anthony Boucher lived in the area as well, and there were many get-togethers with them. At a poker party, one of the writers, an elderly gentleman, tipped a beer over on his lap, drenching the crotch of his trousers. Upon seeing that, Reginald Bretner quipped, neatly altering a line from Shakespeare, "Who would have thought the old man had so much beer in him?" A number of famous and soon-to-be-famous science fiction writers visited our homes in San Francisco, including Robert Heinlein, Paul Anderson, Jack Vance, and Isaac Asimov. Bruce, despite his youth, was developing an interest in science fiction and was eager to participate in conversations with these men. Unfortunately, whenever they arrived, Dad quickly dispatched my brother to his room. Frank Herbert usually had many stories floating around looking for publishers, and being an eternal optimist, he always expected good news to arrive in the mail. It rarely did, but there were occasional checks and letters of encouragement. Bruce and I were under strict orders not to touch the mail. Under no circumstances were we to collect it from the mailbox and bring it inside, because an important letter might fall from our hands and be lost. With my father's lack of commercial success came a steady stream of suggestions from Lurton Blasingame as to how he might do better. The agent kept reminding Dad that he had tremendous talent, citing, as an example, The Dragon in the Sea. In every way possible, Lurton tried to steer his stubborn writer along a path that would produce more fine science fiction novels, since that was where his talent seemed to be. Dad wanted to write a science fiction novel, the desert story he had been researching for too long, but he didn't think it would be anything like what Lurton wanted. This would be a big book, hundreds of thousands of words, perhaps. It would involve a new and dense style of writing, in which he would attempt to layer important messages beneath the text of an adventure, almost subconsciously. He didn't want to think about length or style or any other distraction from his work. He didn't want to worry about such things. Frank Herbert burned with anger about ecology, religion, and politics. He was furious at the publishing world for rejecting past stories he thought were good. And he had this troubling feeling that his agent was defending the publishing world too much, when he should have been fighting it for his client. This impression my father had, as incorrect as it may have been, was blocking him creatively. It was late 1961, and he desperately wanted to begin the new novel. He'd written passages and thrown most of them out. A reason emerged. He couldn't stand the thought of sending any more stories into a New York system that didn't respect his efforts. In his troubled mind, Lurton seemed to represent that system. On Dad's 41st birthday, he released Lurton as his agent, attempting to do it as affably as possible. He asked Lurton to continue to handle royalties and future contracts on any works already in the agent's hands. But for anything written in the future, they had no relationship. Lurton did not argue. He bowed out gracefully, wishing his friend every success. Lurton had no idea what Dad wanted to work on. The desert novel. Afterward, his mind feeling more clear and relieved, Dad wrote a 17-syllable poem in the Japanese haiku style, a short poem that spoke to the essence of his new book. That afternoon, he expanded the poem into prose, eventually setting the poem aside. The haiku was selected for a number of reasons. First, it was a mood setter, a sparse Zen statement about the direction he wanted to take with the story. Haikus frequently concerned subjects of nature, and this book was to have at its core a strong ecological theme. Subsequently, he used other haiku poems for particular sections, or tankas, or Western forms of poetry, most of which he expanded into prose. In this manner, he was able to create beautiful descriptive passages. He considered setting the story on Mars, but soon discarded this notion. Readers would have too many preconceived ideas about that planet, due to the number of stories that had been written about it. Frank Herbert needed something entirely new, totally of his imagination. He would have to construct a world and ecosystem on paper, set in a distant solar system. One winter evening, I heard him read my mother a passage about a young man named Paul Atreides, who was forced to place his hand into the blackness of a box, while an old woman, the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, held a poison needle at his neck, the Gom Jabbar. Though I didn't realize it at the time, this was the opening chapter of Dune. Paul's hand would feel intense pain, the wrinkled crone told him, but if he withdrew it from the box, she would kill him with the poison needle. I was transfixed by the drama of the scene and by the strange words. Gom Jabbar, Muad'Dib, the Padishah Emperor, Kwisatz Haderach, Arrakis, Beni Gesserit, Jihad, Kul Wahad, the throaty, mysterious resonance of words and names as they rolled off Dad's tongue in his powerful voice. I was intrigued by the sounds, and by the way the Reverend Mother used the voice on Paul to control him, similar to methods my father often employed against me. "The language is beautiful," Mom said, after listening to the chapter. Frequently over the years, she spoke of the poetry of his writing, and rarely made suggestions for improvement in that area. Her comments primarily concerned plot when she thought he was getting too convoluted, and characterization, particularly the motivational aspects of female characters. I heard Dad speak passages aloud in his study as he wrote them, before presenting them to my mother. He understood the psychology of human society, the way stories had been told orally for centuries before anything was ever written down, the way troubadours and jongleurs traveled from castle to castle, telling tales and singing songs. He believed readers subconsciously heard the written text through their ears, receiving them as oral transmissions. As a consequence, he labored long hours to obtain just the right word selection and rhythm. The best writing, he believed, touched the subconscious. He enjoyed relating his stories to my mother, a process that recalled times as a boy spent around scouting campfires when he captivated the attention of scouts and scoutmasters alike. It brought back as well darkened bedrooms Frank Herbert shared with his cousins, in which they hung on his every word. Mom enjoyed hearing his tales. She was an excellent listener, as she had been in her childhood, when her Scottish father told her clever mystery stories about caves and secret panels. Chapter 14. The Worlds of Dune. The creation of a masterpiece like Dune was, for an author, the literary equivalent of a baseball player hitting the ball on the sweet spot of the bat and crunching one of the greatest, most memorable home runs ever hit. It not only soared out of the park, it kept going, and fans never tired of talking about it. Dune ascended beyond the realm of science fiction and has been called one of the greatest novels written by any author, and arguably the greatest novel of imagination ever conceived. It was a rare moment in literary history, the creation of a work that would be translated into dozens of languages and would sell tens of millions of copies. It has been widely rumored that Dune was rejected by more than 20 publishers before one accepted it. This is not quite true, or at least it is not the whole story. Actually, it was accepted for one form of publication almost immediately. Dad finished the first novel of an expected trilogy early in 1963 and named it Dune World, a segment of approximately 85,000 words. After years of painstaking research, he produced a remarkable science fiction setting, an entire planet that had once been green and fertile, but was now covered with sand. This was an obvious extrapolation of conditions on Earth, where sand dunes, if left unchecked, were encroaching upon arable land, inexorably marching over large surfaces of the planet, laying good soil to waste. Many of my father's stories placed characters in difficult, challenging situations. The planet Dune, with its vast deserts, lack of water, and giant, dangerous worms, was the most challenging of all. In this harsh, unforgiving environment, special efforts and equipment were required to survive. Inhabitants wore stillsuits to recycle bodily fluids, and dew precipitators on the desert set up to save every drop of moisture. Water was more precious there than gold, a basic truth of all life as well. The human body was, by weight and volume, predominantly water. And after all, he asked, what was life without water? He had a special perspective on the importance of the substance, from time spent in the outdoors and the safety precautions necessary in such environments. Dune World set the stage for a drama that concerned, in large part, problems inherent with finite resources. In The Dragon in the Sea, the finite resource was oil. In Dune World, it was water, and, of even more importance on a galactic scale, a precious natural commodity that was produced only on the planet Dune, the drug Mélange. In both novels, Frank Herbert wrote futuristic versions of hydraulic despotism, an ancient political structure that originated in the Middle East. In that system, a small number of people exerted enormous influence by controlling water that was in short supply. A work of stunning power and imagery, Dune World was not his first story with a desert setting. In 1961, while still researching his big novel, the science fiction short story Try to Remember was published, about an alien spacecraft that set down in a desert region of eastern Oregon, and from there issued an ultimatum to the people of Earth that they must find a way to communicate with the aliens, or face destruction of all sentient life on the planet. He also had the unfinished magazine article based on the government research station at Florence, Oregon, a station set up to control the movement of sand dunes through the planting of special grasses. He had first-hand desert experiences as well. On our second Mexican trip, we stopped in an area of unusual geology, of interest to my father. He walked a short distance out on flint sands and scrambled down a steep embankment into a small arroyo. There he noticed that his footsteps on sand were echoing off the sides of the arroyo. Each step he took produced an eerie, reverberating sound, which he theorized was caused by chain reactions in the crystalline interfaces of the sand. On the way back, we stopped in the same place, and he could not duplicate the phenomenon. It became a key element in the science of the planet Dune. "When the worm has gone, one may try to walk out," Kine said. "You must walk softly. Avoid drum sands, tidal dust basins. Head for the nearest rock zone." "Drum sand?" Halleck asked. "A condition of sand compaction," Kine said. "The slightest step sets it drumming. Worms always come to that." Dad and Lurton Blasingame re-established relations, and the agent agreed to handle the exciting new project. Along with Dune World, the first portion of what would ultimately be published in novel form as Dune, Dad completed and sent to Lurton an outline of intended sequel material, with some of the key passages that would go into the uncompleted sections. As in The Dragon in the Sea, where the basic science was psychology, the technology in this novel was essentially soft, the science of ecology. These books were aimed at a wider audience than the core group of science fiction readers, who got regular fixes on the hard sciences of math, physics, and chemistry. Lurton submitted the material to legendary science fiction editor John W. Campbell at Analog, the successor to Astounding Science Fiction. Campbell, who had earlier serialized Dragon, made a quick offer on Dune World, which was accepted, of 3 cents a word for English language rights. The section Analog was publishing would run in 3 installments, between December 1963 and February 1964. For the second and third installments, Dad wrote synopses of prior events. After deducting Lurton's 10% commission, Dad received $2,295 from Analog. Having seen from an outline and excerpts where my father intended to go with the rest of his story, Campbell said the powers of Paul Atreides were excessive and should be reduced. This was not merely a comment on characterization. If Paul's powers weren't reduced, Campbell insisted, no one could ever hope to oppose him, and there would be no decent plots for additional books in the series. He recommended a major rewrite. The author disagreed and fought for the version he wanted. After a number of lengthy discussions, Campbell agreed to proceed with the story, essentially as written. He and my father reached agreement on a number of minor changes not involving the powers of Paul. In the summer and early fall of 1963, Dad set to work on completing the balance of the trilogy. He considered the rather cryptic title of Sea Oracle for Book 2, but wisely settled upon Muad'Dib instead. Book 3 was entitled The Prophet. In Books 2 and 3, a major plot problem presented itself. Book 1 contained a strong environmental message, and initially in Books 2 and 3, Dad wrote extensive passages involving Paul Atreides' involvement in the ecology of Dune, in which Paul and the Fremen natives of the planet attempted to reverse past damage inflicted upon the environment, restoring it to its former natural beauty. Dad also wrote passages in which the Imperial planetologist, Liet Kynes, was more central to the story. Frank Herbert decided this was too much ado about a sub-theme. The ecology of the planet, while important, was better suited as a backdrop for the primary story he wanted to tell, about a mythology-based future hero. He moved much of the ecological message to the epigrams preceding chapters, and to the first appendix of the work. In the process, between the second and final drafts, he cut 40,000 words from Books 2 and 3, enabling him to focus more on political and religious events surrounding Paul Atreides, the mystical Muad'Dib. Ironically, despite the direction in which the author attempted to point his story, ecology became the most famous and remembered theme of the book. The political and religious themes were often misunderstood by editors and readers. The ecological message was much easier to understand. In the massive piles of books my father read to research Dune, he learned that ecology was the science of understanding consequences. This was not his original concept, but in the tradition of Ezra Pound, he made it new and put it in a form that was palatable to millions of people. With a worldview similar to that of an American Indian, Dad saw Western man inflicting himself on the environment, not living in harmony with it. Doubleday, who published The Dragon in the Sea in book form, had the first option to look at Dune World, Frank Herbert's second novel. Based upon a difficult-to-read carbon copy, they expressed an initial interest in publishing it in hardcover, saying they might make an offer if it could be cut to 75,000 or 80,000 words. Dad thought he could accomplish what they wanted. They indicated that the opening seemed too slow, with the philosophical content too high. A couple of months later, they changed their minds and declined the work. Lurton liked the story very much and never flagged in his enthusiasm for it. It reminded him in many ways of a personal favorite, The Once and Future King by T.H. White. He said Dune World would, at the very least, sell in pocketbook form, and was likely to be snapped up by foreign publishers and filmmakers as well. Lurton was a hands-on agent, part writing counselor and part salesman. He offered advice freely on story points and made suggestions for improvement, some of which my father followed. With a gut feeling that his saga would be tremendously successful, Dad plowed ahead. Shortly before President Kennedy's assassination in November 1963, he completed Books 2 and 3 of the trilogy, Muad'Dib and The Prophet, an additional 125,000 words. When Lurton finished reading the material, he said that Dune World, Muad'Dib, and The Prophet should not be published as separate books. True, he said, there were enough words for three novels, but to him it constituted a single story with no satisfactory points of division, carrying one character through events that occurred in a very short period of time. Book publishers arrived at Lurton's opinion on their own. This was one story, they said, not three. But they felt it was far too long at 215,000 words and would require immense printing costs and a very high hardcover price for the time, in excess of $5. No science fiction novel had ever commanded a retail price that high. Years later, movie producers would express similar concerns about managing the incredible volume of material and producing it in a cost-effective manner that would leave room for profit. Remarkably, Frank Herbert had an even bigger story in mind, and in the writing of Dune World, Muad'Dib, and The Prophet, he wrote large sections of material for two additional books, making a total of 5. In fact, he did have the makings of a trilogy, but the form it would take was substantially different from his initial proposal. The first 3 books would be combined into 1 novel, Dune, 1965, while the latter 2 would ultimately form portions of the novels Dune Messiah, 1969, and Children of Dune, 1976. Book publishers also felt the story would confuse readers. It was too slow-moving and complex, filled with strange, difficult words. Rejections poured in. One editor said he was probably making the mistake of his lifetime in not publishing the work, but declined it anyway. Another said it could attract a cult following, but he didn't want it either. Most editors couldn't get past the first 100 pages. But by design, the book started out slowly, with gentle internal rhythms that evolved through pace and crescendo to a grand climax. Dad said the rhythms were coital, sexual, starting slowly and gradually increasing pace, calculated to touch something deep in the human psyche. An experiment in pacing, Dad called it, an experiment he knew was risky, since publishers were rarely risk-takers. He said they preferred instead to purchase stories that were similar to previously published successful works. 23 book publishers rejected books 1, 2, and 3. They would not publish the material in any form, separate or combined. Analog did snap up the serialization of the entire 3-part work, but again Campbell had a number of suggestions about plotting, characterization, math, and science. Dad's original version of books 1, 2, and 3 of Dune included a scene in which Aaliyah was killed, and Campbell convinced him to revise this, letting her survive. She had an interesting talent, Campbell said, the power to see into the past, and he wanted to see a sequel that focused on her, as well as another story about the Spacing Guild. Despite the closeness with which they worked, Frank Herbert and John Campbell never met one another in person. They had many long telephone conversations and exchanged letters and manuscript pages. My father once told me to put everything into a writing project. Never hold anything back, he said. He put everything into books 1, 2, and 3 of Dune, so much so that by the time he completed the revisions for Campbell, he was wrung out, physically and mentally. All the years of research and intense writing effort left him so drained that for a week straight he slept 12 to 14 hours a day. For the cover of the December 1963 issue of Analog, Campbell selected the extraordinarily talented artist John Schoenherr. The result was spectacular, a haunting alien landscape with a pair of crescent moons on the horizon. The artist captured the essence of the story and the perilous, extreme desolation of the planet. It took him 6 attempts to arrive at a painting he felt was satisfactory. Dad had been studying psychology in depth since meeting the Slatteries in Santa Rosa in the early 1950s. These studies had been instrumental in the characterizations in his excellent first novel, The Dragon in the Sea. Now, in Dune, he carried the psychological aspect to new dimensions, far beyond characterization. With his understanding of subliminal messages, he used color coding in the text of his story. A color, such as yellow, was employed to indicate danger. Thus, when the reader reads yellow, he knows viscerally that danger is imminent. He may not be conscious of the realization, but it is a tugging force that keeps him turning the pages to see what will happen next. Dad also described the subtle body motions of characters, such as hand movements, to indicate more than their dialogue or even their thoughts. The women of the sisterhood, the Bene Gesserit, are able to control people by voice, the subtle use of intonation and precise word selection. Dad learned much of this in studies of semantics he made for the purpose of writing political speeches. Politicians had to be especially careful about word selection in order to avoid alienating large blocks of voters, and in order to appeal to them. He read S.I. Hayakawa's seminal work on this subject, Language in Thought and Action, and the works of other writers in the field. Semanticists of the time recognized the existence of meta-messages beneath actual spoken words, messages that would not be picked up if the words were merely displayed on paper. Something in the tone of voice revealed what was really meant. Perhaps the person didn't actually mean what was being said. Or of two meanings, the normally secondary meaning was really primary. This was linked to my father's studies of the subconscious and to his analysis of subliminal advertising. For the names of heroes, he selected from Greek mythology and other mythological bases. The Greek house Atreus, upon which House Atreides in Dune was based, was the family of kings Menelaus and Agamemnon. A heroic family, it was tragically beset by flaws and burdened with a curse pronounced on them by Thyestes. King Menelaus was the husband of Helen of Troy, whose abduction by Paris led to the 10-year Trojan War. Menelaus's brother, King Agamemnon, led the confederated Greek armies in the war. Upon returning from Troy, Agamemnon was murdered by his wife, Clytemnestra. This suggested the troubles Frank Herbert had in mind for the Atreides family. The evil Harkonnens of Dune are related to the Atreides by blood, so when they kill Paul's father, Duke Leto, it is kinsman killing kinsman, just as occurred in the household of Agamemnon. In Greek mythology, Leto was the mother of Apollo and Artemis. In Dune, Duke Leto is a man, the opposite sex of the mythological base. Dad said he did this in order to highlight a Janus facing in the story. Janus was the ancient Roman god with two bearded faces, one looking forward and the other looking backward. One of the children of Duke Leto, Paul, can look far into the future, while the other child, Aaliyah, can see far into the past. The Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam was in part named after Helen of Troy. The characters fit classical archetypes from mythology. Paul is the hero prince on a quest, as described by Carl Gustav Jung, Joseph Campbell, and Lord Raglan. One of the books my father studied, Raglan's The Hero, published in 1936, outlined 22 steps followed by classic heroes. These included, all of which closely approximate the life of Paul Muad'Dib. A. The hero's father is a king, a duke in Paul's case. B. The circumstances of his conception are unusual. C. He is reputed to be the son of a god. Paul is reputed to be a returning god, a messiah. D. An attempt is made to kill him at birth. In Paul's case, the attempt occurred in his youth. E. After a victory over the king and or a giant, dragon, or wild beast, he, F, marries a princess, Irulan. His wife, in name only, is the daughter of Emperor Shaddam Carino. The mother of Paul's children, Chaney, is the daughter of a king-like figure to the Fremen, Liet Kynes. And G becomes king. In the sequel to Dune, Dune Messiah, Paul continues in the classic pattern of a hero when H, for a time, he reigns uneventfully, and I prescribes laws, but J, later he loses favor, and K, he meets with a mysterious death, and L, his body is not buried. Other mythological archetypes were found in Dune as well, including a fool, Rabban, a witch mother, Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, a virgin witch, Aaliyah, and the wise old man of Dune mythology, Pardo Kynes. The planet Caladan was named from Caladon, a town in ancient Greece where the Caledonian boar was hunted. This was one of the most famous stories of Greek mythology. Dune is a modern-day conglomeration of familiar myths, a tale of heroism and great sandworms guarding a precious treasure of melange, the geriatric spice. The planet Dune features thousand-foot-long worms that live for untold years, ferocious, dragon-like monsters who have great teeth and a bellows breath of cinnamon. This is the pearl of great price myth. In the Bible, a parable described a man who obtained a great treasure and then kept it hidden. This parable was linked to mythological stories of protected treasure, such as the golden fleece of the sacred ram sacrificed to Zeus, given by Phrixus to his wife's father and nailed to an oak tree, where it was guarded by a dragon that never slept. In Beowulf, written by an unknown English poet, a ferocious fire dragon guarded a great treasure hoard in a lair under cliffs at the edge of the sea. A close reading of the epic poem reveals interesting detail, in which the dragon is described as a worm. A foul worm, a dragon, took it upon itself to hold sway through the heavens at night. It seems there was a worm that slept upon a pile of treasure, which it had zealously heaped up under a stone bluff. The worm took to the air, burning the houses of men, belching red fire in his anger. At a writing workshop recorded by his friend Bill Ransom, Dan said that the heroic warrior Duncan Idaho was named with a place in mind, the state of Idaho. Such a technique has traditionally produced solid-sounding appellations, such as Dutch, Scotty, and Tex. For the antagonist family, he selected a harsh-sounding name, Vladimir Harkonnen, which to the Western ear sounded Soviet, a suggestion of the communist enemy in existence at the time Dune was written. Dad found the name Harkonnen, which is actually Finnish, in a California telephone book. And, as he typically did in his stories, Frank Herbert included a friend's name in the novel. One was Holjens Vonbrook, an anagram of Jack Vance's full legal name of John Holbrook Vance. Another was Paul Anderson, under the anagram Pander Olsen. See Dune, Terminology of the Imperium, Crimskow Fiber, and Lady Aaliyah Atreides. The planet commonly known as Dune is called Arrakis by the ruling nobles, a harsh-sounding name that is suggestive of an inhospitable place. And inhospitable it is, under the short-sighted, usurping control of the noblemen. The very name Dune is like a great sigh, suggestive of a faraway, exotic land. The native Fremen have blue-within-blue eyes there, and they use an unauthorized planet name in defiance of authority. The name Fremen, pronounced Frem-men, sounds close to Freemen, a suggestion that they are an independent, rebellious tribe who will never permit themselves to be dominated by outsiders. According to edicts from the imperial military political powers holding this place, the desert world is named first Arrakis and later Rakis. But the Fremen of the desert, who have been there since time immemorial, understand the spirit of Dune and of the great maker worm Shai-Hulud. These are rebels, and the very name they use for their world, Dune, suggests this. No outside force, no foreign authority, can force them to alter their ways. It was this spirit of rebellion, of human defiance against injustice and oppression, that Frank Herbert captured so magnificently when he set up his desert world and the empire encompassing it. He pitted Western culture against primitive culture, and gave the nod to the latter. In a later work, Soul Catcher, he would do something similar, and again he would favor old ways over modern ones.
In a tragic, ironic scene, Imperial planetologist Liet Kynes lies dying on the sands of Arrakis, left there by the Harkonnens without a stillsuit.
They do this thinking it will be amusing for the planet to kill its ecologist, despite all his efforts, despite everything he knows about the environment. As my mother pointed out, this makes his death all the more terrible, knowing that his life could have been spared with a stillsuit, knowing that water is only 100 meters beneath the surface of the sand. Liet Kynes is a metaphor for Western man, bearing all the adornments of scientific and cultural knowledge. But the rhythms of his life and imperial society, like the rhythms of Western society, are out of sync with the rhythms of the planet. Intensifying the irony, Kynes sees desert hawks approaching, preparing to slash him, waiting to feed upon him when he dies. Hawks that his father brought in from another planet to regenerate the ecosystem of Arrakis. Like the nomadic Bedouins of the Arabian Plateau, the Fremen live an isolated existence, separated from civilization by vast stretches of desert. And like the Bedouins, the Fremen feel their lifestyle is superior to that of more civilized people. The Fremen take psychedelic drugs during religious rites, like the Navajo Indians of North America. And like the Jews, the Fremen have been persecuted, driven to hide from authorities and survive away from their homeland. both Jews and Fremen expect to be led to the Promised Land by a Messiah. The life and legend of Wadib are rooted in the familiar religious concept of messianic impulse, along with the idea of a political and religious superhero. These themes are found in Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, and other faiths.
Frank Herbert even used lore and bits of information from the people of the Gobi Desert in Asia, the Kalahari Desert in Southwest Africa, and the Aborigines of the Australian outback.
The Fremen are also like any number of peoples who throughout history have concealed themselves in inhospitable mountain or desert regions, using them as bases of guerrilla warfare against more powerful occupying forces. The Turks did this after World War I, when their country was occupied, while the Yemenis Arabs and Algerians did it after World War II. The tactic has been particularly effective against colonial powers, making occupation too expensive to continue. The Germans and Spanish resisted Napoleon's occupying armies in this manner. So did the North Vietnamese, driving American forces from Vietnam. The Fremen of Dune do this as well, resisting the occupation of the Imperial Empire and its franchise holder, the Harkonnens. In creating the Fremen, Dad called upon personal memories of the Great Depression, in which the hardy, stubborn personality survived best against adverse conditions. The author understood the survivalist mentality, the ability of human character to overcome difficult circumstances. Under his interpretation, the behavior of such people in extreme situations, such as those found on Arrakis, became inseparable from religion. It was ingrained in their group personality, in their ethics, and the religion of these people was in large part based upon the mystical practices of societies of people whose spiritual belief systems originated in desert regions. Muslim Sufis, Jewish Kabbalists, Navajo Indians, Kalahari and Gobi primitives, Australian Bushmen, and more. The Fremen religion spoke of the pillars of the universe, a cosmology that derived in part from the four pillars of the Christian universe, the New Testament Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Master Chef Frank Herbert concocted quite a banquet for the senses of his readers. His sprinklings of mysticism blend surprisingly well with portions of ancient mythology and handfuls of Jungian psychology about the workings of the subconscious. It all works because the reader, more visceral than he realizes, is a conglomeration of these things after millions of years of human history. The reader identifies with passages without consciously knowing why. Dad studied and incorporated aspects of the life of the Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmed, who operated in the Egyptian Sudan in the 1880s and claimed to be a messiah. The Mahdi led rebellious Arab forces against the colonial British Empire. Dad also studied the life and literature of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, a British citizen who, during World War I, with Faisal, son of the Sharif of Mecca, led Arab forces in a successful desert revolt against the Turks. Lawrence employed clever guerrilla tactics to destroy enemy forces and communication lines, and came close to becoming a messiah figure for the Arabs. This historical event led Frank Herbert to consider the possibility of an outsider leading native forces against the unlawful occupiers of a vast desert land, and in the process, becoming a messiah to them. He studied other historical military strategies and tactics as well. When Paul Muad'Dib attacked the Harkonnens under cover of a desert storm, this was an operation reminiscent of Eisenhower leading an Allied invasion in 1944, aided by a storm that concealed much of the movement of his forces. The Butlerian Jihad of Dune's history was a movement against machines, preventing them from ever exerting domination over men. This touched upon the natural fear humans have of machines. In recent years, this apprehension is focused largely upon computers, upon a fear that computers can be loaded with artificial consciousness and intelligence that will be superior to humans in important respects, eventually relegating men to subservient status. The distrust of machines is actually, perhaps, a fear men tend to have of anything they do not understand, of things that are arcane and unpredictable from their perspective. The roots of the Butlerian Jihad went back to individuals my parents knew, to my mother's beloved grandfather Cooper Landis, and to our family friend Ralph Slattery, both of whom abhorred machines. Whenever Mom had trouble with a machine, she invoked Cooper's invective, well known in our household. Oh, the mindless malignancy of mechanical devices. In Dune, the Bene Gesserit sisterhood had a collective memory, a concept based largely upon the writings and teachings of Carl Gustav Jung, who spoke of a collective unconscious, that supposedly inborn set of contents and modes of behavior possessed by all human beings. These were concepts my father discussed at length with the Slatteries in Santa Rosa. The Bene Gesserit were in part based upon my father's maternal aunts, who attempted unsuccessfully to convert him to Irish Catholicism in his youth. The three experiences my father had with drugs provided details that he wrote into the story of Paul Moadi when the character took Mélange, the precious spice drug of doom. Mélange was irresistible, addictive, capable of transporting its user to alternate realms. It is interesting as well that at the bottom of a bottle of mezcal, an intoxicating Mexican beverage, is a tiny worm which is said to contain so much essence that people have been known to hallucinate after consuming it. My father, of course, spent considerable time in Mexico. I find pieces of our family history throughout my father's writings, and particularly in Dune. Lady Jessica, with her beauty, intelligence, loyalty, and love, represented the way my father felt for my mother. She was perfection to him, all things that were right with his life. She was his strength and sustenance, nurturing all of us. Like the busy Duke Leto Atreides, my father was too wrapped up in his work to pay adequate attention to his offspring. Much of this responsibility was left for Lady Jessica, just as it was left for my mother in our family. Lady Jessica's etiquette, like my mother's, was always impeccable. Such women knew how to behave in different, often challenging situations, no matter the faces each situation presented. In Lady Jessica's case, if she needed help with a decision, she searched her Bene Gesserit past lives to determine the best course of action. It is interesting in this vein to note that adab, the demanding and instant memory of the Bene Gesserit, is a word in Turkish Arabic for etiquette and politeness. The Bene Gesserit genetic memory and the surrealistic effects of Mélange were occult phenomena, akin to the interests and powers of my white witch mother. These literary creations were linked with events in my father's life, including Rhine consciousness card predictions he made in the 1930s, his studies of Jung's collective unconscious theory, and personal experiences with hallucinogenic drugs. Frank Herbert himself was in many of the characters in Dune, for they sprang from his mind. He was the dignified, honorable Duke Leto, and the heroic Paul as well. He was the swashbuckling risk-taker in Paul and in the loyal Duncan Idaho as well. Dad's religious and philosophical beliefs closely approximated those of Paul Atreides, combining the wordless, enigmatic elements of Zen with the self-determination of existentialism. My father once told me he felt he was most like the Fremen leader Stilgar. This surprised me until I realized that Stilgar was the equivalent of a Native American leader in the story, a person who defended time-honored ways that did not harm the ecology of the planet. Stilgar was an outdoors man, like my father, a person more comfortable in the wild reaches of the planet than in its more civilized enclaves. Such a strong name, Stilgar, combining the phonetic elements of steel and guard. He was the stalwart and determined guardian of Dune, a position not dissimilar from the one my father placed himself in with respect to Earth. Portions of the book were semi-autobiographical. Only a short while before, in 1961, Dad had been at the lowest point of his literary career, unable to write. He had been 41 at the time, with a chronic sick feeling in the pit of his stomach, a fear that he had wasted his life. Recollections of that crisis come instantly to my mind whenever I read this excerpt from Dirge for Jameis on the funeral plane in Dune. Time has slipped away. Your life is stolen. You tarried with trifles, victim of your folly. I lived with my father during the years he worked on Dune, and I understand a great deal about the making of the work. Nonetheless, The creation of this magnificent piece remains to me almost beyond comprehension. I find something new and intriguing in it on nearly every pass through the pages. My father was a man who spoke to me often of the importance of detail, of density of writing. He understood the subconscious, wrote his books in vertical layers. He said a reader could enter Dune on any one of numerous layers, following that particular layer through the entire work. On rereading, the bibliophile might choose to follow an entirely different layer. Despite all the work Dune required, my father said it was his favorite book to write. He used what he called a technique of enormous detail, in the process of which he studied and prepared notes over a 4-year period between 1957 and 1961, then wrote and rewrote the book between 1961 and 1965. In all, it took the better part of a decade to complete the work with all the changes his editors wanted. Dune is not a novel to be grasped entirely on first reading. There are important messages beneath the adventure, deftly intertwined with the action of the story. The layer of action is the most obvious one, the one most readers follow and remember best. It is an essential component, my father told me, for without structuring a book well, without remembering to entertain first, an author cannot hope to hold a reader's attention. Frank Herbert said he was in love with language, particularly the English language. Dune is a marvelous tapestry of words, sounds, and images. Sometimes he wrote passages in poetry first, which he expanded and converted to prose, forming sentences that included elements of the original poems. There are natural rhythms to life, to the desert, to forces of nature, and he wanted his book to echo such rhythms, with onomatopoetic words that imitated the sounds they were describing. As he worked, he enjoyed listening to a wide variety of music, with the volume turned up, so it is not at all surprising that his best writing took on musical qualities. Writing was like a jazz performance for him, he said. He composed it as he went along. He could slow it down, speed it up, soften, intensify. Some poetry in Dune was modeled after Provençal lyrics, the court poetry of troubadours in southwestern France and the Mediterranean between the late 11th and mid-13th centuries. To understand this style, Dad read the lyrics of poets of the period, including the work of Bernard de Ventadour, whose courtly love poetry is considered the finest surviving example of that style. He also enjoyed Japanese tanka verse, with 31 syllables. He even studied and wrote Italian and Shakespearean sonnets. Like Provençal lyrics, much of this poetic form originally concerned the subject of love. The subjects commonly found in these poetic forms are interesting, as they correspond with key subject matters in Dune: nature, in haiku and tanka, and love, in Provençal lyrics and in sonnets. Thus, the atmosphere of a universe was constructed, with small and large pieces, layer upon layer, like a painter. In interviews later, including one with his friend and collaborator Bill Ransom, Dad said poetry was like a baseball player swinging three bats as he walked up to the plate. Frank Herbert was building the muscles required for prose writing, developing a powerful sense of rhythm and word selection. The Japanese haiku is a Zen Buddhist art form, and the Pranabindu discipline of the Bene Gesserit was based upon Zen disciplines. Aware of a simmering women's liberation movement in the early 1960s and the desires of women in religious service for more recognition, Dad decided to postulate a sisterhood in control of an entire religious system. He thought readers would accept the premise of women with occult powers of memory, since females have traditionally been said to have women's intuition. St. Paul the Apostle was considered the greatest advocate of Christianity, so it seemed appropriate to Frank Herbert to name the Messiah of his new desert religion Paul. The Christian thread in Dune is strong. An orange Catholic Bible is in the book, suggesting a future merging of Protestantism and Catholicism, and there are numerous references to Christian ethics. Dad's early religious influence was Catholic, from his maternal aunts, which formed one of the bases of the Bene Gesserit. Jesuit was a name selected intentionally to sound like Jesuit. Dad referred to the Bene Gesserit as female Jesuits. My mother's early religious influence was strongly Protestant. Many entries in the Orange Catholic Bible were Zen, speaking of sensing alternate worlds that were all around, and of great truths not easily expressible in words. Through his association with Irene Slattery, Dad knew of the studies of Professor Gilles Quispel of the Netherlands, a well-known religious historian. In the mid-1950s, Quispel became aware of an archaeological discovery near Nag Hammadi in Upper Egypt. An Arab found several ancient papyrus manuscripts in a large pottery jar there, many of which involved Gnostic Christian scripture that, for political reasons, had never been included in the Bible. At Quispel's urging, the Jung Foundation in Zurich purchased one of the manuscripts, a leather-bound codex. That codex contained the Gospel according to Thomas, which included a number of astonishing quotations ascribed to Jesus Christ, passages that sounded more like Eastern religious thought than Western. This was one. Bring forth what is within you, and you will be saved. The Orange Catholic Bible of Dune, with its cryptic mystical entries, had a strong basis in historical fact. There were sand trout in the deserts of Arrakis, and the fish was an early Christian symbol. When in a sequel to Dune, Children of Dune, 1976, a character allowed sand trout to attach themselves to his body, this was based in part upon my father's own experiences as a boy growing up in Washington State, when he rolled up his trousers and waded into a stream or lake, permitting leeches to attach themselves to his legs. There is much of the outdoors man Frank Herbert in Dune, the technique of sand walking, in which a person moves without producing a rhythm that might attract giant worms, is a technique my father learned in his childhood. The hunter moves silently and downwind from wild game so as not to alert the prey of his presence. The fisherman does not make a disturbance in or near the water for fear of frightening away the fish. Frank Herbert knew from personal experience that living in harmony with nature was best, moving through it without disturbing it, taking from it, but only in ways that permitted renewal. One day he would become a leading proponent of wind and solar power, and would even propose obtaining methane from chicken droppings. "Use every part of the chicken, except the squawk," he would quip. On a philosophical level, living in the desert was not so different from the forest or the farm. Man had to pay close attention to resource preservation and recycling, to the preservation of systems. Nothing was wasted. The land was not to be stripped of its nutrients if it was expected to be usable in the future by our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Dew precipitators were set up on the deserts of Arrakis to catch precious moisture, and humans traveling in desert regions wore stillsuits to recycle and preserve bodily fluids. When Stilgar and Paul set hooks in giant worms and climbed up them to the top, it was like mountain climbing, driving metal pins into rock and ice for footholds. The hooks in worms were reminiscent of fishing as well, but an extrapolation beyond anything most people could ever imagine. The Mentats of Dune, capable of supreme logic, were human computers. In large part, they were based upon my father's paternal grandmother, Mary Stanley, an illiterate Kentucky hill woman who performed incredible mathematical calculations. Mentats were the precursors of Star Trek's Spock, first officer of the Starship Enterprise. Frank Herbert was an investigator who turned over rocks and made human creatures scurry out of hiding places. A modern-day Socrates, he tore into what he termed unexamined linguistic and cultural assumptions, and in so doing, he extrapolated words and traditions he thought might exist in the future. He observed that bits and pieces of the diversified past were entrenched in our own language and culture, and he saw no reason why this pattern of creation would not continue to hold course. He said there would be segments of the past, of today, nestled into words and customs thousands of years from now, like nearly forgotten detritus. This accounts for the diversity of religious fragments encountered in Dune. It also accounts for Frank Herbert's exceedingly broad selection of words. Many of the words in Dune were rooted in Arabic and Hebrew, and in numerous cases he combined syllables from two languages, two cultures, or even two religions. He referred to Zen-Sunni teachings, for instance, whereby Zen-Buddhism and the mystical Islamic denomination Sunni were joined. Such words suggest past historical events without detailing them. They also point to a fact of history. Languages change. They are in a constant state of flux, never static. Words appear and evolve. The words and names in Dune are eclectic. The word Sihaya is Navajo. Bene Gesserit is rooted in Latin. Ch is Chikobsa, a language found in the Caucasus. Tliloxu is based upon a word for salamander in the Nahuatl dialect of the Aztecs. Atreides, as I have said, is based upon House Atreus from Greek mythology. The Padishah emperor ruling the universe of Dune is from Persian, East Indian, and Turkish tradition. Jamis is an Old English name my father found when researching genealogical records. Jihad is Islamic for holy war, and this word has the same meaning in Arabic as it does to the people of Dune. The Fremen language is based upon colloquial Arabic, in a form my father believed would be likely to survive for centuries in a desert environment. Aliyah is a name given to female descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, a name that means noble one or beloved of God. His desert is a great sea with giant worms diving into the depths, Shai Hulud's domain. Dune tops are like the crests of waves, and there are powerful storms out there, creating extreme danger. On Dune, life emanates from the Maker, Shai Hulud, in the desert sea. Similarly, all life on Earth is believed to have originated in our seas. Frank Herbert drew parallels, used metaphors, and extrapolated present conditions into world systems that seem entirely alien at first blush. But close examination reveals that they aren't so different from ordered assemblages we know, and the book Characters of His Imagination aren't so different from people familiar to us. If Frank Herbert could be categorized in a religious sense, and that is a very big if, he came closest to Zen Buddhism. It was in that realm that he felt most comfortable, most certain of his footing. He did not participate in the dogma or rituals of any religion, though his deep commitment to ethics and the survival of humanity were apparent throughout his writings. He believed in quality of life, not merely in scraping by, and he spoke deftly, and at times didactically, about this through his characters. Sometimes, in his characters, Frank Herbert spoke with Frank Herbert, exploring different avenues of his own belief systems, typically having to do with religion or the politics of power. At other times, he spoke through people who represented, to him, anathematic types. The mainstream of Buddhism is a highly ethical belief system, one that had great appeal to Frank Herbert. Of no little importance to him, Buddhists hold a spiritual reverence for nature and for the preservation of life on this planet. Dad also believed that Buddhists tend to be tolerant of the belief systems of others. Certainly there are exceptions, but for the most part he didn't see them in possession of the holier-than-thou missionary fervor of Western religions. It is interesting in this vein to note that the stated purpose of the CET, the Commission of Ecumenical Translators, as described in an appendix to Dune, was to eliminate arguments about religions, each of which claimed to have the one and only revelation. This is particularly revealing in light of the childhoods of my parents, when adults attempted to force-feed religious dogma to them. Dune, the first novel in what would ultimately become a series, contained hints of the direction he intended to take with his superhero, Paul Muad'Dib, clues that many readers overlooked. It was a dark direction. When planetologist Liet Kynes lay dying on the desert, he remembered these words of his father, spoken years before and relegated to the back reaches of memory. No more terrible disaster could befall your people than for them to fall into the hands of a hero. And at the end of an appendix, it was written that the planet had been afflicted by a hero. These were sprinklings, here and there, seeds of the direction Frank Herbert had in mind. The author felt that heroes made mistakes, mistakes that were amplified by the numbers of people who followed those heroes slavishly. By the second and third books in the series, Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, this message would become clear. In another seed planted in Dune, he wrote, "It is said in the desert that possession of water in great amount can inflict a man with fatal carelessness." This was an important reference to Greek hubris. Very few readers realized that the story of Paul Atreides was not only a Greek tragedy on an individual and familial scale. There was another layer, larger than Paul, and in that layer Frank Herbert was warning that entire societies could be led to ruination by a hero. In Dune and Dune Messiah, he was cautioning against pride and excessive confidence, the hubris of Greek tragedies that led to the Great Fall. But it was societal-scale hubris he was warning against, the potential demise of an entire society. Among the dangerous leaders of human history, my father sometimes mentioned General George S. Patton because of his charismatic qualities, but more often his example was President John F. Kennedy. Around Kennedy, a myth of kingship formed, and of Camelot. His followers did not question him, and would have gone with him virtually anywhere. This danger seems obvious to us now in the case of such men as Adolf Hitler, who led his nation to ruination. It is less obvious, however, with men who were not deranged or evil in and of themselves. Such a man was Paul Muad'Dib, whose danger lay in the myth structure around him. One of my father's most important messages was that governments lie to protect themselves. They make incredibly stupid decisions. Years after the publication of Dune, Richard Nixon provided proof. Dad said that Nixon did the American people an immense favor. By example, albeit unwittingly, Nixon taught people to distrust government. Frank Herbert believed in the importance of long-range planning, particularly with respect to the environment. He spoke of adaptation, of setting forces in motion to change the attitudes of men toward their own planet. In Chapter House Dune, the sixth volume of the series, Reverend Mother D'Ortuzla used an aphorism familiar long before the publication of Dune. Never damage your own nest. That was Frank Herbert speaking, of course, since he believed we were doing precisely that to Earth. One of the layers of Dune was an ecological handbook written by planetologist Pardo Kynes and his son, Liat Kynes. Ahead of its time, it described the consequences of human actions. Environmental awareness was just awakening in the early 1960s, and Frank Herbert was one of the standard bearers. In 1962, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, a monumental work that decried the killing of birds and harmless insects by toxic chemicals such as DDT. In 1963, shortly before the opening installments of Dune were published by Analog, the first Clean Air Act was passed in the United States. President Kennedy gave a couple of speeches that year about protecting the environment. Analog readers liked Dune World, and fans nominated it for the 1963 Hugo Award for Best Novel. Rather unusual, since the story hadn't yet been published in book form. While Dune World did not win the award, its popularity was in no small part responsible for the awarding of a Hugo for Best Science Fiction Magazine to Analog and its editor, John W. Campbell. At the awards ceremony, held at the Pacific Con 2 Science Fiction Convention in Oakland in 1964, Dad accepted the award as Campbell's proxy and shipped it to him. During 1964, however, a steady stream of publishers rejected Dune World and its allied manuscripts in book form. Dad lost hope that it would ever be published in anything more than a magazine. Trying to maintain his sense of humor, Dad came up with this: Chinese rejection slip. Illustrious brother of the sun and moon, look upon the slave who rolls at thy feet, who kisses the earth before thee, and demands of thy charity permission to speak and live. We have read the manuscript with delight. By the bones of our ancestors, we swear that never before have we encountered such a masterpiece. Should we print it, His Majesty the Emperor would order us to take it as a criterion and never again print anything which was not equal to it. As that would not be possible before 10,000 years, all tremblingly we return the manuscript and beg thee 10,000 pardons. See, my head is at thy feet, and I am the slave of thy servant. In the January 1965 issue, Analog began a new serialization of the 125,000-word completion of the story, books 2 and 3, under a single title Campbell preferred, Prophet of Dune. It would run in 5 monthly installments, ending in May. Early in 1965, a few weeks after publication of the first installment of the new serial, Sterling E. Lanier, an editor with Chilton Book Company and a science fiction writer himself, Sterling Lanier wrote the novels Hero's Journey and Under Marswood, contacted Lurton Blasingame. Lanier had read the analog installments, and when he finally got his hands on a complete copy of all three manuscripts, he wanted to publish them in a single edition. In the buy of an editor's lifetime, the literary coup of coups, the far-sighted Lanier offered a $7,500 advance, plus future royalties, for the right to publish Dune World, Book 1, and Prophet of Dune, Books 2 and 3 in hardcover. His offer was accepted. Lanier said there were a number of loose ends in the story and rough transition points between books 1, 2, and 3 requiring more work. He wanted the entire work expanded. When he discovered my father had drawn a map of the planet Dune, he asked for a copy to include it in the book. Lanier proposed a simple title, Dune, which he liked for its power and mysticism. For the cover art, he wanted to use John Schoenherr, who had done such a fine job on the analog covers. Chilton was best known as the publisher of a series of automobile repair manuals, leading Dad to quip that they might rename his work How to Repair Your Ornithopter. Ornithopters were the bird-like flying craft of the planet Dune. At least Chilton had experience printing large books. Their auto repair manuals were huge. A short while after the Chilton agreement was reached, Ace Books, a well-known publisher of science fiction titles, made an offer to publish the book in paperback. That edition would appear in 1966, a year after release of the hardcover, in order to allow the higher-priced hardcover to run its course before receiving competition from the paperback. Chapter 15, Number 2 Son. What is the son but an extension of the father? Frank Herbert in Dune. During the period when Mom was working in downtown San Francisco and Dad was writing the most difficult segments of Dune, he became increasingly irritable and more intolerant than ever of the slightest interruption to his concentration. It reached the extreme where he took the house keys away from Bruce and me and told us he was going to write inside a locked house. We were commanded to go elsewhere after school, and he didn't seem to care where. Dad and Bruce got into a big row over this, and Dad yanked a string with a house key on it off Bruce's neck. Prior to that, my brother had been in the habit of coming into the house after school to make a sandwich. Unhappy with the way Dad was treating him, Bruce ran away, walking more than 25 miles. Only 11 years old, he crossed the Golden Gate Bridge into Marin County and hid in a creek bed for several hours. The more he thought about his predicament, however, the more Bruce realized how cold, lonely, and hungry he would be if he didn't return home. And he realized how angry Dad would be at him for yet another interruption to his writing process. It must be understood that the son of a writer is not without creative energies of his own. To avoid Dad's wrath, my little brother came up with a wild, rather ingenious tale. He contacted the nearest police precinct in Marin County